Let's welcome Deanna Witkowski Trio.
Thank you. And Chip probably already said this, but I missed it if he did. If you could also welcome, this is Dave Ambrosio on the bass. And Scott Latsky on drums. All of you should have a booklet. Most of these pieces are things we're going to be playing in the next session, but there's two things you'll want to be aware of in this booklet for now. One is the last page is sort of a resource page. This lecture, I'll say workshop, because I'm not really going to lecture, but is called Jazz and Christian Worship, and we're going to talk about some other jazz artists besides myself who have written liturgical music in the jazz idiom. And this page lists some of those people, one of whom is actually here with us, Chuck Moronic, who lives here in Louisville and has written a great deal of sacred jazz music. There's some websites, there's some other stuff there. And my website, I didn't put on here, which is kind of silly, but it's deannajazz.com, and I'm going to be talking a lot about Mary Lou Williams, a great jazz pianist and composer, and a lot of her music is available on my website in video form in a presentation we did at the Kennedy Center last May. So I just want to make you aware of that at the outset. But we're going to start with a piece that's kind of in the middle of your handout called Let My Prayer Rise. This is something that I wrote. It's a setting of several verses from Psalm 141, and I would like you to feel free to join in on the refrain. I'll let you know when you can come in.
The lifting of my hands as the evening. lifting of my hands as the evening sacrifice.
That was a piece to give you some context that I wrote, I think, in 2001 or 2 for a jazz hymnal project that Chuck also wrote some pieces for. Bill Carter, who is a jazz pianist and a Presbyterian pastor outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania, got a grant from the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship to put together a jazz hymnal. And so a bunch of different musicians, including myself, wrote some pieces for that. And this was I wrote three pieces that were setting texts that could be used at evening services. So I forgot to say, I often do this in the morning, and we just substitute morning sacrifice for evening sacrifice. I think it's okay to do that. So Bill is a resource that's listed on that handout. His website is on there. We're going to talk about some other musicians who have written liturgical jazz music, and the one that I have the most personal connection to and probably know the most about is a woman who is named Mary Lou Williams. And this May, it will be the 100th year of her birth. She was born in 1910, obviously, and was a great pianist, arranger, and composer. She was doing gigs as early as age 9. She was playing in her Pittsburgh neighborhood and basically providing for her family. She grew up always playing music, was never formally trained, ended up in her late teens playing with different groups that would tour in the South, and eventually in the late 20s and 30s, she was touring with a group led by a bassist named Andy Kirk. He had a group named the 12 Clouds of Joy, and she became their star pianist and arranger. I mean, basically, they found out that she could compose besides playing. And she eventually arranged for Benny Goodman, for Earl Hines, for Duke Ellington. So these are all major jazz musicians. She learned to orchestrate, obviously, not just for small groups. We're talking for larger groups. She had a piece in the mid-40s, I believe, called the Zodiac Suite, which was a bunch of different pieces that she wrote for various jazz musicians in a piano trio format that she recorded. And she eventually did this in a small orchestral setting at Town Hall in New York. She played at clubs like the Village Vanguard, which still exists. Other clubs at that time that were important called Cafe Society, the Downbeat Club. Anyway, this is all basically to say she was this amazing musician, was very well respected, but she also struggled a lot as jazz musicians. We all know what that means. she was African American, and she was a woman, and she had many obstacles to overcome. She eventually started her own record label because she couldn't get certain things recorded that she wanted to record. That's something I've also done. She started her own publishing company, and she also had a heart for really trying to help, especially a lot of musicians who struggled with not just financial problems, but with various addictions, people in her own family who had problems with alcoholism. And she would take all these people into her apartment in Manhattan. And this actually became, it was a blessing and a curse for her, because it took so much of her energy away from her. When she went to England in the early 50s, in 1952, she was offered a two-week English tour, and she ended up staying in Europe for 9 years. And while she was in France, she had an extended solo piano gig at a club, and she started just wrestling with various things, just kind of having an emotional almost breakdown, but something where she was kind of going back over her life and questioning what had meaning for her. And it was at this point in her life where one of her very devoted fans in Europe, who was an American expatriate, his name was Edward Brennan, and he was a devout Catholic. And he introduced Mary to a church in Paris that just had this little outdoor garden where she could pray. And she actually spoke of this place later as saying that this was where that she felt that she found God, was in this garden, in this church in Paris. So this was sort of where, at least you can pinpoint where at least Mary Lou herself said she started having this conscious search to try to get close to God and wondering what that meant. She started also becoming a bit reclusive and stopped taking certain performing engagements. She moved for a while with a friend to a house outside of the city in Paris because she just needed quiet. She needed solitude, and she started reading the Psalms. When she came back to the States finally in late 1954, she pretty much turned down all of her live performance work in nightclubs. She would only take work on the radio. She did a few recordings. She did an important history of jazz recording called A Keyboard History, where she played in various different styles. She was always big on showing the history of jazz, the history of jazz piano, blues, boogie-woogie, swing, all these different things. But she felt that being in an environment playing in nightclubs, she felt that this was something she couldn't do at this point in her life. She felt that it was sinful. She lived in Harlem and found a Catholic church in her neighborhood that left the doors open during the day. And so she started going there and just spending hours praying. She started making lists of people to pray for, and she eventually got up to having 900 names of people she would pray for every day. So you can imagine that this took a very long time, that she was in the church for a long time praying for each person because she felt that she had to pray for each person by name. She was very good friends with Dizzy Gillespie, the great trumpet player, and Dizzy's wife, Lorraine. And while Dizzy and Lorraine were on a tour, a South American tour, I believe in Paraguay, they met a guy who was a Catholic priest there and who was a jazz lover. And this priest, when he came back to the States, he came to the East Coast. His name was Father John Crowley. And he met with Mary Lou, and he encouraged her to return to live performance. He encouraged her to say that your music is a gift from God that you can offer to others. Mary Lou and Lorraine started attending classes at a church in New York. It's still there. It's called St. Ignatius Loyola on Park Avenue. And studied with someone there named Father Anthony Woods. And these classes basically were catechism classes, Catholic catechism. And both Mary Lou and Lorraine converted to Catholicism at the same time in 1957. They were baptized together and received into the Catholic Church together. And for Mary Lou, I think this was very important for her music, because she finally, especially through these two priests, and especially Father Anthony Woods in New York, who was kind of her spiritual mentor, who really encouraged her to not just turn down all her live performance work, she started to feel like she could play again in public. And this also marked a point where from 1962, there was a 10-year period where Mary Lou started writing liturgical music. So she started marrying jazz and the liturgy. She had written one large-scale choral piece in the 40s, but that was only performed once. But besides that, that particular piece, she hadn't, as far as we know, have written anything that had Christian text for worship. So if you think back to the early 60s, so many things going on, civil rights, the Second Vatican Council with the Catholic Church, and Mary Lou's first, one of her first pieces that she wrote in 1962 during the Second Vatican Council, and it was a hymn for St. Martin de Porres, who was the first person of color who was ever canonized in the Catholic Church. So we're going to hear just a little bit of this piece. Jason, it's track one. This is a big choral piece, St. Martin de Porres.
St. Martin de Porres, ye gentle creatures, tame and wild.
Thanks, Jason. This piece is actually available now. I believe it's on that handout, but if it's not, I just wrote an article on Mary Lou last week, and I have another resource page that lists all the links to her sacred stuff that you can get now. This piece was released on a recording in 1964 called Black Christ of the Andes, and it was released on Mary Lou's own record label, Mary Records, but Smithsonian Folkways re-released this a couple years ago, so you can get it on iTunes. Mary Lou was very big on jazz education. I mean, I would go as so far as to say that she was an early pioneer of education, jazz education in schools. She went back to Pittsburgh in the mid-60s, and she convinced the bishop there to let her teach jazz in a Catholic girls' school. She also convinced him to help sponsor the first Pittsburgh Jazz Festival, which ran for a few years before it folded. But she was very much always seeking opportunities to have jazz in different places, including in the church. And it was while that she was at this particular Catholic girls' school in Pittsburgh that she started writing her first mass. According to her, she was teaching a theory class, and she felt that the kids in the class weren't really that into the music theory. So she would have them take a break, and she would write eight bars of her mass setting, and then she'd teach it to the kids. And this literally became something that she did for years. She had young people always performing her sacred music whenever she would tour around and play in different churches all over the place. She always had choirs with young people in many of these different churches where she performed. So that was her first Mass. She wrote three complete Masses. She wrote a Mass for the Lenten season, which was done for all of Lent in 1968 at another church in New York that still exists, at St. Thomas the Apostle. And then at that point, she went back to Europe, and she had originally been scheduled to perform the second Mass, Mass for the Lenten season, in Rome, and it was going to be in honor of Martin Luther King. It was in early 69, so not that long after he had been assassinated. And unfortunately, after she got to Rome, she was told the piece could not be done in a worship setting, in a service setting, I should say. She was told she could perform it in a recital, but the reason given was that she used percussion, and percussion was not allowed. Scott, percussion was not allowed, of course, in services. So at least at this particular time in this particular place. So Mary Lou was very disappointed, and because she had worked for so long on this, and she ended up again basically touring around and going to different seminaries and schools in Italy and doing the piece without percussion. So she still got to do the piece, but she wasn't able to present it in a way that she wrote it. It was while that she was in Rome in 69 that she received a commission to write a third Mass, and it was called Mass for Peace. And this is the Mass that we have recordings of. This is the only one we have a full recording of today, and it's the one that's the most well-known. We're going to play some excerpts from it. And this piece of, or this Mass, if you listen to a lot of it now, you can tell it's really late 60s, early 70s. It sort of combines like this jazz rock fusion feel. It's a little bit of a dated sound, but she was really seeking to involve young people again, as I mentioned, and she felt that by combining a certain type of music, a certain type of groove, that she would be able to get young people interested in this music. So she was finally able to present her third Mass, Mass for Peace, which was eventually choreographed by Alvin Ailey and renamed by him as Mary Lou's Mass, and she presented it at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, which is it's the huge seat of the Catholic Church in New York, in 1975. So we're going to play a couple of selections.
Let's start with the Lord's Prayer
from Mary Lou's Mass. And this first one is a setting of the Lord's Prayer. And if you get the recording, Mary Lou's Mass, I love this setting, especially on the recording, because there's a woman named Carlene Ray who is still around. She still gigs in New York. She's an electric bassist and a vocalist, a classical vocalist. And she has a super low, I mean lower than contralto. She has like a tenor voice, and it's amazing to hear her sing this piece. She's on the recording. So this is Mary Lou's setting of the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom.
We're going to go back and do another one of Mary Lou's pieces that was written earlier than this third Mass. This was something that appears on the 64 recording of Black Christ of the Andes. And it's, again, keep in mind, she was writing all this music to be used in worship services. And she was Catholic, so much of these are settings of prayers that Catholics would say either in weekly services. Some things are written for the rite of confession. And so this is the prayer Anima Christi, which is sometimes said after receiving communion. And one thing that's also interesting when you hear this recording, I didn't have ever make Dave and Scott do this, but there's this little background choir that sings in the rest, so I just have to fill there. So you can pretend that they're singing.
Be my sanctification, body of Christ, be my salvation, blood of Christ, fill my face, water of Christ, side wash out my stains, passion of Christ. To walk from thy side, guard me should the foe assail me, call me when my life fails me, bid me come to thee.
We're going to do one other Mary Lou piece. And some of these pieces are really short, but one thing about Mary Lou's music, as opposed to some other people who were writing liturgical jazz music at the time, often we think about, or at least I think that Duke Ellington's sacred music is better known, but he called them sacred concerts. He wrote three sacred concerts and actually wrote the first one after Mary Lou had started in this genre. And Ellington's pieces really aren't service music per se. In other words, they're not taking the text of whatever, if it's a Catholic service, as in Mary Lou's case, and taking the text of a Mass or taking a psalm setting or taking the Lord's Prayer or the Apostles' Creed and setting the text. Ellington's pieces aren't, and for another thing, Ellington's pieces are not written for a large group of people with average singing voices to sing. Mary Lou was really trying to write in such a way that she was integrating her music into the liturgy in a way that many people could join in singing together. We're going to do one more of her short pieces, and this is a prayer that would be said, or a prayer like it would be said, when someone goes to receive confession. So this is called Act of Contrition from Mary Lou's Mass.
Detest all the sins of my life. Sorry for having offended thee, who art all good. I resolve with the
In Mary Lou's, in her later years, she was an artist in residence for 4 years at Duke University, and actually the three of us played there. They have a Mary Lou Williams Center, and we gave a presentation on Mary Lou Williams with a woman named Dr. Tammy Kernodle, who wrote a biography called Soul on Soul, which is about Williams, and that's listed on your handout. Mary Lou, we even found out, actually, when we were on tour playing at Duke a year and a half ago, she was a really popular teacher. She had these history of jazz classes where she had hundreds of people in the class, but she had tons of people on waiting lists to get in her class. So she really, her love of, I think, working with young people was a big part of her music, not just her specifically, her music with the sacred text, but her, the way that she talked about the history of jazz and her other music, that was a big part of it. She, before she died in the last year of her life in 1981, she formed the Mary Lou Williams Foundation, and there's a link for that on that resource page. And that's a really important resource, because if you want to perform any of Mary Lou's music, you can go to that website, and there's an email there for Father Peter O'Brien, who was Mary Lou's personal manager for the last couple decades of her life. He's also a Jesuit priest, and he's the one who has really continued Mary Lou's legacy in a major way. There's also another great resource listed on that handout, I believe, is for Rutgers University. They have an Institute of Jazz Studies, and I visited there. They have a whole wing devoted to Mary Lou Williams, and they also have an online exhibit, which it's great because I can just sort of scratch the surface, but you can read and hear excerpts of a lot of her music besides her specifically music with the sacred text. So those are all resources on Mary Lou. I want to mention a couple of other musicians. I mentioned Duke Ellington, and we're not going to play any of his pieces because I was trying to think about what are pieces that are used in service settings. And Ellington's music, you can easily find his three sacred concerts and listen to them, and they're great, but they're just not really meant for service use. One musician who you probably all know, though you might not know his name, was Vince Guaraldi, who wrote Charlie Brown. That's how I knew Vince Guaraldi, was his music from all the Charlie Brown specials. And he wrote some liturgical music. We're going to listen to one clip of something that he did for Grace Episcopal in San Francisco, and this was in the late 60s. And I picked this example specifically because I think it's something that you can use no matter what kind of service you're in, if it's a Catholic church, if it's Protestant, if it's Baptist, Presbyterian, whatever. This is an excerpt, it's going to be number 5, Jason, but not quite yet, where they're saying the creed, and here I think it's the Nicene Creed, and you hear people kind of just singing what they're used to singing. They don't have to change anything, they're singing on one or two pitches, and there's music, there's instrumental music with different harmonies changing underneath. So let's hear track 5.
I believe in one God,
the Father Almighty, Maker of heaven and earth.
So now you hear
it. All things visible and invisible, and in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of God, the Author of His Father before all worlds.
You get the idea. So basically there's harmony changing underneath the constant pitch. It's just like everyone's singing along pedal point. They're singing chants and the instrumental musicians are changing underneath them. And I think that this is actually a really simple way to incorporate different, I mean it doesn't have to be jazz, but this is a way that's really incorporating different harmonies just underneath something that people already know. And it's something that we do sometimes. In the next session, we're going to be playing a lot more of my pieces and talking about different spots and different services where we've used them. But that's something that you don't even need to really teach the congregation. They just do what they know, and then you can change things underneath. And there's other pieces from that setting, from the Vince Guaraldi Grace Cathedral concert, that are more composed with other people singing as well. I should also mention Dave Brubeck, who is listed on the handout too. He has a lot of more large-scale choral pieces with sacred text. And we'll just listen to a little portion of his cantata, The Gates of Justice. And this was something he wrote. It was first, again, you know, it's interesting. A lot of the pieces I'm talking about right now were all written in the mid to late 60s. So this was something right after Martin Luther King's assassination that Brubeck first performed this piece. And he actually, I think I wrote this down, he wrote this piece basically built around something that Martin Luther King had said. He had said, "We must live together as brothers or die together as fools." And then he wrote this piece based from that. So we're just going to hear the beginning of track 9. This is called Open the Gates. This is a big choral thing. That's fine, thanks. So there, I think, you know, Brubeck stuff, again, that's not something you're going to pull in your congregation to all say, "Open the gates, Paul!" You know, I think that'd be a little scary unless you're ready. But, you know, you hear there his thing. I mean, probably a lot of everyone knows Brubeck's Take 5 and in his pieces where he's writing things with, like, odd meter or doing different rhythmic things. And you hear that coming in there, but a lot of his pieces are really more for large-scale choral pieces, and it's great. It's just a different style. I've listed some other people on here that I would say that everyone I've listed on this handout, and I don't know why I didn't list myself, but I figured you see me, but I didn't list my website. But I've already mentioned Chuck Moronic, who is here, and Bill Carter, Brenda Earle, who is a friend of mine who has been, just left actually, her music director position at an Episcopal church and is a jazz pianist and vocalist. She's written about 3 jazz masses at this point, and she has a ton of congregational music too. Ike Sturm is the music director for the jazz ministry. They actually have a whole jazz ministry at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in New York, and he writes at least 1 new arrangement per week for the congregation to sing on a, they have a different, the way they structure their services, they have different jazz groups come in every week, and there's only 1 congregational hymn that's sung per service, so Ike always arranges that hymn. Ruth Naomi Floyd, I don't know her music as well, but she's a great jazz vocalist who's done a lot of sacred stuff. I don't think that much of it's congregational, though. So I was trying to think of people who have written stuff that you can go purchase their sheet music and try it out and see if you can use some of it in your church. I also have, I brought with me, I'll give a little plug, I'll just show you. Oops. I brought with me 2 connected songbooks. I just finished at like 7 a.m. yesterday this songbook that has fully notated piano parts as well as lead sheets and congregational bulletin inserts for all of the music from my new sacred recording from this place, which we'll have at the concert and have here afterwards. So you're welcome to look at this stuff afterwards. We have them here. Thank you, Chip. And a lot of this music is congregational as well. And you can also purchase things individually at my website. It ends up being twice as much when you do it that way. But you're welcome to look at all this stuff. So I just mentioned this for later. I think we're going to play one more hymn arrangement that I've done, and then we're going to, I'm trying to leave 15 minutes for questions. So,
let's do the Spirit of God.
One thing that I really like to do, in the next session we'll be focusing more on specifically congregational music that I've written. But this piece is not written for a congregation to sing. I guess they could try, but one thing I like doing is taking hymn texts, where sometimes I just read through hymn texts, and when I started getting into writing a lot of music, setting these texts, when I had a full-time job as a music director at an Episcopal church in New York in 1997, and found that there was so much text that I just felt like I wanted to be able to enter into in a deeper way, which often for me comes with music. So I would often take particular hymns that might fit the theme for the day or the scripture readings for the day or whatever, and sometimes I would just write a whole new melody to the text. So this is one of those pieces. Fairly new. I wrote this last summer, and it's to the text, Spirit of God, descend upon my heart. Which, how many of you know this hymn? Some of you? I can't even think. I can't find the chord, but it's usually, Spirit of God, descend upon my heart. That's usually the hymn tune we know it with. So it's taking that text and a different take on it. When you're done with the random thing. That's why they couldn't have percussion in Rome. Spirit of God, descend upon my heart. Wean it from earth through all its pulses move. Stoop to my weakness, mighty as thou art, and make me dream, no prophet ecstasies, no sudden branding of the veil of clay. No angel visits and no opening sky. Thank you. Thank you. So I think we'll open it up for questions. We have about 15 minutes. And since we don't have a microphone, if you just want to stand up and speak, and hopefully I can hear you, and then I'll repeat your question into the mic. Well, I do that all the time. I mean, Dave and I played duo in an Episcopal church 2 weeks ago where they're just bringing in some different musicians. They're kind of consciously like trying to expand their musical palette and seeing what the congregation responds to. So, you know, since I worked in an Episcopal church for two different music director positions for a total of maybe 5 years, I know that liturgy pretty well, and so a lot of my music really fits there because it was written for that. So when we do things, you know, maybe we should play one of those short pieces. Let's do the Kyrie. So I have things that are written, whether it's portions of the Mass setting. No, you don't have to look at your handout for this, even though it's in there. Because I bet that you can learn this without looking at it. I have stuff that's written that's simple enough for congregations to sing. Either I have hymn arrangements, like I have All Creatures of Our God and King, where you can say, I know the number in the Episcopal hymnal. Open to page 400, and people will look there if they want to look at the music. Most people know that tune. And we have an arrangement that's changed a little, but they pretty much can sing along right away. I mean, I think a point of entry for a lot of people is the text, because I have a lot of pieces. I have a setting of Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior, Take My Life and Let It Be, where people have been singing this text with a certain tune their whole lives. And so they have some, they know the text, but when they hear a different setting of the text, it allows them to maybe experience that text or hear the text in a new way. It's like when you open the scripture and you read a psalm, Psalm 139, that you've read your whole life, and then one phrase, I am fearfully and wonderfully made, just like hits you on a certain day. You know, I can't explain how that happens, but I believe that it's God somehow working in that. So I think we have people come up to us all the time and say, I mean, or I at least do, who say, oh, I thought I didn't like jazz, or I didn't know what this was going to be, or I thought I didn't know where I was going to have be able to come in, you know. And usually I think because I have the background in working as someone who's a jazz musician but also has a church music background, able to bring it together. So what I was going to say is, let's do the Kyrie. This is something I wrote when I was working at All Angels Church. And I had a gospel choir, and the gospel choir introduced this piece to everyone before we sang it as a congregation. So we have it. We'll just do it. I'll sing a part, and then I'll have you join me. So this is just Lord Have Mercy.
Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. mercy.
Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy on me. Lord, have mercy.
There it's something where the soloist is the one doing the Christ have mercy in the middle. And if there's also, you know, there's difference too when I'm leading from the piano. I can't, you know, lift up my hand to be like, join us. You know, if there's someone, because often, sometimes we're working with choirs. We're playing at a Methodist church in Lexington on Sunday where the choir is going to sing the Kyrie with us, and they're going to sing some other things with us. So there, the person who's the music director can turn around and, you know, hold up their hands, and no one has to look to remember, Lord, have mercy. It's pretty easy, you know. I think the same thing with Let My Prayer Rise. It's something people don't necessarily even need the sheet music for. And it's people who, for people who want it, it's there, too. So, I don't know if that answers the question. More questions?
How well does this simplify to people that really aren't jazz musicians but would want to try it out or something? You know, I mean, can these songs still work if you don't have people that are as good as you guys at jazz?
Okay, so I forgot I'm supposed to repeat the question for recording. So the question, tell me if I'm saying this right, is for musicians, right? So for musicians who aren't jazz, like trained musicians, how is playing these particular pieces, will it work in a setting? Well, that's part of why I've written out piano parts, because I had enough pianists come to me and say, I know some theory and I know my major and minor chords, but I don't know much about, you know, like voicing chords for jazz, or I look at a melody with chord charts and not quite sure how to flesh it out. So I consciously tried to write out piano parts for pianists who aren't really, you know, jazz people, to get some kind of, for one thing, like chords that pretty much sound like the chord I meant to write, hopefully, you know, and try to make it in a way that, you know, I'm not writing every little thing. I mean, you're welcome to look at the parts afterwards and see and sit here and try it out if you want. But I tried to write with the sense of people who are not improvising in mind. And then the good thing is, too, that the lead sheets are in there, and I have the chords on top. So people can learn from that, too, you know, how... Then when I see this, like, F sharp minor 7 chord, what do I do in another song? You know? So hopefully that's a resource that can help. So the question is, where in different kinds of demographics, where does this music work and where does it maybe not work? Well, for one thing, I would say that usually when I'm going somewhere, there's a chance it's going to work because I've been invited to come. You know, they're not picketing outside, I mean, so far, you know, So there's already like an openness to try something, which I think is sort of the number one thing, you know, really. And I played it. I mean, I honestly can't remember. You guys can speak to this too, because Dave and Scott have played in tons and tons of churches with me. I mean, I have never encountered a situation where someone has come up to me and said, I didn't like this or that. I mean, they're probably scared to tell me, but when I was a music director at a church, they weren't always scared to tell me. Oops, that's on the recording. You know, but it's a little different because it's like I'm a guest coming in. But I think I can also tell you that where I have felt the music really gelling the best has been, for instance, in situations like where, like, I can think of, we've played and we're playing there in a year in their concert series at a church outside of Portland, Oregon. It's an Episcopal church. And the guy who's the music director, he loves my music. And he like taught some of it to his choir. He did some summer concert where they did like some pieces just on a concert with some other material. And then he taught the music with his choir, introduced it to the congregation for a few weeks or something before we came. And I actually remember coming there and hearing like this congregation that really sings. And it was like, you know, so maybe 300 people like really singing the music like fully. And feeling like that was a really, for me, it was great to feel like these people are feeling like they can participate, because it's not meant for us to be up here just doing something, you know, by ourselves. So we have pieces like that Spirit of God one I did where it's meant for us to do as a trio, but for the pieces that are meant for a group of people to sing, like any way to facilitate congregational singing, which often happens with me working with the music director ahead of time, but it's a lot of, you know, the music director, when they put in the work ahead, that's when I've really seen things work well. Do you have any comments on this?
No, I think that's true. It's like kind of if the music director or whoever's there is more open to kind of incorporating this stuff, then I think it works a lot better. Fit it into what they normally do or something.
Like, I can also, I can think of another example where things worked, but where I didn't feel good. I played at a church sometime last year where, and again, like, I put in lots of planning back and forth with either the pastor or the music director. So things were planned, and when I got to the church, two of the congregational pieces had been cut, and I hadn't been told. And I was then told by the person who had done this that they felt that the pieces were too hard for the congregation. But I said, but I needed to know that before, because I didn't want to sing this as a solo. This was, you know, so it's partially just communication and being open about, I mean, I think it's a thing about trust too. It's hard coming in like as a guest musician once, you know, because it's the pastor and the music director and myself, there has to be an element of like, well, we're going to see what happens, and, you know, but usually it works out really well.